So tonight we are doing part three of five parts, studying orthodoxy in society. We have spent the first two nights looking at sort of introducing the document known as the Foundations of the Social Conscious Awareness of the Orthodox Church, looking at the introduction for that, looking at church and nation, church and state, looking at topics like Christian ethics and secular law, the church and politics, and tonight we're turning to labor, property, war and peace, and hopefully, if we get that far, crime, punishment, and reformation. So these are all topics that I think are very, very interesting, and I tried to condense stuff a little bit so we can get through it a bit faster. So labor, the document says, is an organic element of human life. The book of Genesis says that in the beginning there was not a man to till the ground. But having created the Garden of Eden, God put man in it, it says, to dress and keep it. Labor, then, is the creative fulfillment of man who was called to be the co-creator and co-worker of the Lord by virtue of his likeness to God. However, when man fell away from the Creator, the nature of his labor changed. And so we hear the Lord say in Genesis, "In the sweat of thy face thou shalt eat bread till thou return to the ground." So, sadly, the creative component of labor weakened, and labor became just about staying alive. You know, we work to live. But the reason God made us creatures who could work was because he made us to labor like he does, which is to create, to build, to create things that are new and beautiful and glorious because we're like God. The Word of God does not only draw people's attention to the need of daily labor, but also sets a special rhythm to our work. The fourth commandment says, "Remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy. 6 days thou shalt labor and do all the work, but on the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord. Thou shalt do no work, thou nor thy son nor thy daughter, thy manservant, not the maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger within thy gates." So in the Christian church we have the tradition of the Sabbath day, which comes from Judaism. Now, of course, it's confusing sometimes because people think the Sabbath is Sunday. For us, it isn't Sunday. The Sabbath remains Saturday.
I know.
Because the very language in Greek and in other in Greek, it's Sabbaton, is Saturday. Yeah, Russian, it's Subota.
Sunday is Kyriaki.
And so in Greek, it is the Lord's Day, Kyriaki. In Russian, it's Voskresenye, which is resurrection. But the day of rest for us has been transferred in a sense. The day of rejuvenation is now the Lord's Day, which is the first day of the week, or the eighth day of the week. But regardless, in God's plan, time is sacralized. There's a rhythm to our work, there's a rhythm to our rest. It continues here, "The improvement of the tools and method of labor, its division into professions and move to more complex form, contributes to better material living standards for people. However, people's enticement with the achievements of civilization moves them sometimes away from the Creator and leads to an imaginary triumph of reason, seeking to arrange earthly life without God." You might call this the Tower of Babel problem, right? You know, civilization grows, you have people, you have technology, you can build stuff.
I
think the Enlightenment is one manifestation of that tendency.
Oh, yeah.
But mankind, by, you know, the whole hallmark of mankind's civilization is that we build and we do things that leads us to forget God.
Yeah.
Whether it's the Tower of Babel or the Enlightenment. You might even call it this kind of Star Trek ideology. I love Star Trek, but I mean, yeah. The Star Trek ideology is a type. It's a vision where we're humanistic, and it's we're progressing toward this life without God.
Yes.
So.
So
I'm going to keep going. The Holy Scriptures point to two moral motives for labor. The first is we work to sustain ourselves so that we're not a burden to others. We work to live, to be able to provide for ourselves. Secondly, we work to give to the needy. The apostle writes, "Let him labor, working with his hands, a thing that is good, that he may give to the brother in need," Ephesians 4. Such labor then cultivates the soul and strengthens the body, enables the Christian to express his faith in God-pleasing works of charity and love for neighbor. Everyone remembers the words of St. Paul, though. If you would not work, neither should you eat. So there's this kind of balance between things. For us, we want to make sure that we're working and we're taking care of our needs, but we want to take care of those who have legitimate needs who cannot work. This is very much part of our Christian calling. The fathers of the church all point out the great moral value of labor. You think about so many saints in history. Saint Benedict, he taught the two keys to the monastic life were prayer and work, right? Mm-hmm. Work would help save you. You even think of Saint John Chrysostom says this, not labor, but idleness should be regarded as dishonor. Work is honorable. It is good. And so monks and nuns and Christians have always had this identity that work is redemptive. And this is why, too, at different times, even with penal colonies, you'd have work as part of the component, because the work would help rehabilitate those who might have fallen into sin. So these are all really important things. The church will bless almost any kind of work, whether it's physical. I mean, it could be physical labor. It could be intellectual work. It could be work, financial work. Of course, the church would not bless things that are immoral, like prostitution, for instance, right? The church can't bless that. Any questions? The church would teach as well that a worker has a right to the fruit of his labor. Consider, for instance, 1 Corinthians 9. Whoever plants a vineyard eateth not the fruit thereof, right? Who feedeth the flock and eateth not the milk of the flock? He that ploweth should plow in hope, and he that thresheth the floor in hope that he would be partaker of the fruits. And then St. Paul's talking specifically about pastors should have a right to ask for financial help from the community. Now that pastors, apostles, and others should be able to get support so they can full-time engage in their work. But that applies, I think, across the board. If we plant a field, we should be able to reap the fruits in that field.
That's how work should be.
That's how it should be.
That's why it's such a tragedy that you have places where, like, there's these plantations where, like, people are growing cocoa beans, but they've never tasted chocolate.
That's crazy, yeah. Which leads to the next point here. Holy Scripture says, thou shalt not oppress a hired servant. At this day thou shalt give him his hire, lest he cry against thee to the Lord, and it be a sin to thee. So if we cheat someone that's in our employ, we do wrong by God, and we do wrong in society. So it's very important to pay honest wages. This is an important teaching of the Old Testament, and by analogy, it certainly is true in the New Covenant as well. At the same time, by God's commandment, workers are ordered to take care of those who cannot work, such as the weak, the sick, the refugees, the strangers, the orphans, the widows. The worker should share the fruits of his work with them, as it says in the law, that the Lord may bless them in the work of thy hands. So I think it's fair to say that Orthodoxy would not oppose and would encourage some kind of social security, social safety net, you know. That is not anathema to us. In fact, it's a positively good thing.
It would be like a little bit like charity work built into the system.
Some people say, and I find this a little bit troubling, some people point out, well, if the state didn't collect so many taxes, the church would have the resources to take care of the poor. But what's worth noting is the only societies where the church has had resources to take care of the poor on a large scale are societies where the state has been of the Orthodox faith. So
yes.
Like Byzantium did this, but Byzantium's church hospitals were funded by the state.
Yes.
The state collected taxes on them, and then the church would partner with the state to do this work. Or Imperial Russia, for instance, there were many wonderful philanthropic works, but people didn't pay tithes, really. They paid their taxes, and from their taxes, it was like tithes to the church. Like the state and the church collected together, and the state took its cut, and the church took its cut. And that's how it was sort of a one package system. So there really is no... In the ancient times, of course, Christians did take care of the poor, but they couldn't take care of everybody because they were a small portion of the population like we are now. You know, in America, the Orthodox are 0.5% of the population. And if you count up church-going Christians, it's probably maybe 20% of the population total. So Christians aren't, it isn't like everyone's going to church contributing to this. So I don't think there's anything wrong. I think I think Christians should be glad that the state, even though the state isn't Christian, we should be glad that the state has taken up the attitude in some way of taking care of people. That's a very Christian attitude, and we should be grateful for that. So, I want to wrap this up here just 1 second. This is a great quote: continuing on earth the service of Christ, who gave himself to the poor, the church always comes out in defense of the voiceless and the powerless. Therefore, she calls upon society at large to ensure the equitable distribution of fruits of labor, in which the rich support the poor, the healthy help the sick, and the able-bodied help the elderly. The spiritual welfare and survival of society are possible only if the effort to ensure life, health, and minimal welfare for all people becomes an indisputable priority for the nation. Section 11, the next section in this broad document, is on property. It says in paragraph 1, property is commonly understood as a socially recognized form of people's relation to the fruits of labor and natural resources. The basic powers of an owner normally would include the right to own and use property, the right to control and collect income, the right to dispose of, lease, modify, or liquidate property. It's kind of simple. It continues, the church does not define the rights of property. However, the material side of human life is not outside the vision of the church. While calling the people to seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, the church does not forget about the people's need for daily bread and believes that everyone should have the resources sufficient for life in dignity. At the same time, the church warns against the extreme attraction to wealth, denouncing those who are carried away by cares and riches and pleasures in this life. The church and her attitude toward property and material goods does not ignore material goods or needs, nor does she praise the opposite extreme of loving wealth. The status of a person in itself cannot be seen as an indication as to whether God is pleased with them. So richness or being rich or being poor does not indicate how blessed you are. And of course, we know that there are many saints who embraced poverty. And we'll talk about that more in a second. But we would also know that when they embrace poverty, they do it voluntarily. No one's taking their money from them, making them poor. They do it by choice. One of the key principles in Orthodoxy for how we see property is this idea of stewardship. So according to our church, people receive all that they have from God, who himself owns absolutely everything, right? Everything we say, thine own of thine own, we offer to thee, right? In the liturgy, everything is his. It all belongs to him. So we're offering him what is already his. However, he entrusts to us as stewards the good things of this world. Land, food, buildings, material items, even family. We are stewards of these things. But we would affirm, of course, that wealth cannot make men happy. The pursuit of wealth, it says here, makes a baneful impact on the spiritual condition of a person and can lead him to complete degradation. St. Paul points out that they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of evil. And Jesus says to the man who is rich, if thou be perfect, go and sell what you have, give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come and follow me. So there's this definite call in Christianity. Wealth is not evil, but it's easily turned into an idol that can dominate our life. And if we have the wherewithal to divest ourselves of riches, it's a good thing. And so there is no doubt in the Christian tradition, even when the wealthy maintain their status as wealthy, there are many saints who are wealthy, but they're celebrated for their great generosity without exception, without fail. One point that's really important to make about property is that without the ownership of property, the ownership of stuff, it's impossible to make an offering. And one of the most important ideas in Christianity is that we make an offering to God. We make the bread. It's our bread, right? We take the land. We work the land. We make that, well, for farmers, we get the flour, you know, then we take the flour and we fire it up and we make bread. And it's our bread and we give it to the Lord, and he makes it the Eucharist. We give tithes and offerings to the church. We give money to the poor. If we don't have stuff, We can't do that work. So even monasteries, as monasteries own property, they own and they're able to do charitable works from their own monastic stuff. But personally, the monks have nothing, of course.
Yes.
But as a group, they do,
yeah.
And they can make offerings. So the scripture recognizes the human right to property, and would deplore any encroachment on that. Think about the Ten Commandments. Two of them deal with don't steal, and don't covet your neighbor's stuff. So like, it's definitely clear in the Old Covenant that there's value to property, and safeguarding that is part of the teaching of our faith. The church also would support the rights of intellectual property, scientific work, inventions, information technologies, art, copyright, basically copyright, right? Intellectual property, the church would support that being affirmed. In general, the church cannot approve the alienation and redistribution of property with violations of the rights of the owners. An exception to this might be made only for the alienation of property based on law, conditioned by the interest of the majority of people, and accompanied by fair compensation for those who lost something. For instance, I'll give you one example. My father's property once was confiscated by the state.
What was the
property? This is America, right? It sounds very Soviet the way, but it's not. He had property located near downtown Jacksonville, near the stadium. And when the city invested money to redo the civic area, they had a baseball stadium and an arena, football stadium and the fairgrounds, they needed more property. And so they went to him and they offered him money, and he didn't want to take it. So then they said, well, okay, we're taking it by law. And they voted to, it's called eminent domain. It's a whole class of law. And in the interest of the state, the city government took the property, and they gave him money, not what my dad wanted, but they did. Now, I'm not saying that's super right or super wrong, but that's what the state does sometimes. And that's
was he not allowed to have, was it land, or was he not allowed to have it?
Because they needed it for
was
development.
It Native American land or something?
No.
They're saying that the right to confiscate that is more important than his right to really have it.
However, and you'd contrast that, perhaps.
Is he making a bad use of it?
No. The contrast would be, though, under Bolshevism, they would just take properties and nationalize them and not pay any compensation.
Yeah, that was evil.
And it created, first of all, great disturbances in society, great bitterness in society, and it was almost like the land was possessed by people who were just stealing and looting, and it was a real demonic kind of force.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, it was unfortunate with my dad that he lost his property. That was not good. On one level, but there was a process involved that was by law, there was a procedure, and he was also reimbursed for that and was able to take his business to another part of town. So in the end, it didn't harm him.
Well, I would argue that we generally have limited property rights, because if you own a home in most parts of the country, you don't get to live there and not pay the...
You got to pay taxes.
If you stop paying property tax, they'll eventually take it away from you.
Well, and you know what's interesting? That very idea.
So you're renting.
That very idea goes back to the.
Might as well just be rent to if I can't even own.
It goes back to the idea of the king. In British English common law, the king owns everything.
Right.
And he leases out land to people, and they can own it, so to speak, as long as they fulfill their obligations to the state. And this is a very ancient thing.
Okay.
Many cultures have it, including our own. This is not an American thing. It actually goes back to the British Roman times, I think.
Sure. You've got to have taxes somehow.
So,
schools and roads and all that.
So in Christian history, communities would often pool property together, abandoning personal propriety aspirations. We call this monasticism, right? That's what monks do. They give up their property. They live in common. Of course, in the early church, there were instances where Christians had communities, but the church would always say, we would say, these are voluntary things, and the only way that can be healthy is if people choose to do it of their own free will.
Yes.
And so that's good. You can live as a monk or nun in a commune, Generally, I'm not aware that it works well for married people. There might be some examples where they try that. But as a Protestant, I knew people who lived on communes, and it was usually not very successful. It created all kinds of problems.
What kind of problems and what kind of commune model are we talking
about? Well, that's a rabbit trail. I'll come back to if you want to. Afterwards, I'll talk to you about
like,
it.
Was it like gated community?
No.
Later.
So anyway, we would affirm, I mentioned already, we would affirm the importance of safeguarding the church's donations. One of the ancient privileges conferred upon the Christians by Constantine was the right for tax-free gifts to the church. This was something that goes back to him. But also in the Old Testament, the offerings given to the temple were sacrosanct. The state could not take from them. What was earmarked for the temple went to the temple. And Constantine affirmed this as a point of law, and it's remained in the West as part of our law into the present day, which is part of why when you hear people in D.C. talk about taking away tax exempt, that's an incredible innovation. And I think the church should rightfully oppose that. I'm a man, I like tradition, like things, I just think something that's been around for 1,500 years we should not take that away too quickly.
Yeah.
So that ends our little section on property. So section 8 of the document is called War and Peace. And I made a comment that America, as of the year 2016, has been at war longer than any point in our history. 15 years of continual combat. No, it's not funny. It's horrifying.
I like the horrifying things.
It's horrifying.
It's horrifying.
Wait, well, so that would be since I was, what, 4 or 5 years old?
Perhaps, if you're 19.
9/11. I was 7 and 9/11 happened, and suddenly we were at war with Iraq.
So I'm going to read the first paragraph here. War is a physical manifestation of the latent illness in humanity, which is fratricidal hatred. It goes back to Genesis, right? The idea of Cain and Abel. Wars have accompanied human history since the fall, and according to the gospel, will continue to accompany it until the end. So war is here. It's evil. But we would say that war is caused by the abuse of freedom that all men have engaged in. Violence against the other, taking for the sake of taking. And this is part of the fallen state. Killing without which wars cannot happen was regarded as a grave crime against God. As far back as the dawn of history, thou shalt not kill, the law begins. In the Old Testament, as in all ancient cultures, blood is sacred since blood is life. So when we talk about shedding of blood, it's a big deal.
But it was okay for Joshua and the Jews when they were reclaiming the promised land.
Go
in and he was actually helping them win war.
Yes. Let's come back to that. That's an important topic. We'll come back and talk about that.
How does people always do that to attack Christianity?
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, I'll say, here's what the church fathers do with it. The church fathers would say, the very point of that story is not about the Jews or the Israelites killing people. They would read that entire story as an allegory of our spiritual struggle. So we are the people of God following our Joshua, because the word Joshua is the name for Jesus. Yeshua, Joshua, Jesus is the same name. We follow our Jesus, our Joshua, across the river of baptism into the promised land of our heart. And we have to occupy our heart. But the problem is, in our heart reside all these aliens, all these passions and things that have taken over the fertile soil of our personhood and have hijacked it, so to speak. And so Jesus is leading us into the land to occupy it once more. And it's a war. And it requires violence, spiritual violence, right? Struggle and work and effort and vigilance and the not compromising with darkness to restore the heart to its proper place. That's what the fathers, when they read that story, that's what they do with it. Now, I'm not arguing whether it's historical or not.
But they would say, I think in the Bible verses, kill all of the enemies so that their blood can't mix with Jewish blood.
Yep. Right? Yep. Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty extreme.
It is.
We don't want to leave any sin in our hearts either.
That's the thing, root out every sin. That's what that means.
I don't believe that. You're telling me that only the Jewish people are sinners?
No. What Wes is saying, though, is as Christians, we read that not about the Israelites killing all the Gentiles. We read that as about we have to do the violence against all those sins in our heart.
Right. If there be any wicked way left in me, or the crops I've after my baptism, or whatever way, that needs to be considered.
Rooted out.
Right.
They must utterly perish.
Right.
But I'll tell you what. If I met the Old Testament, if I met an unvarnished... If you look at biblical history, there's a clear arc where they're going from the law and they're a unique people with a unique deity. As you go deeper into Jewish history, they have an awareness that God is calling the Gentiles. They can't just be about themselves. Isaiah talks about how the Gentiles will come up to Jerusalem and they will declare the glory of God. The Israelites evolve under the influence of God. From a warlike people who are only concerned with themselves to being a people who produce the Messiah. And the fathers see a moral progression from childhood to adulthood. And so we have no problem as Christians seeing that same pattern of growth from simplicity to depth. And so, you know, initially the law is just a teacher to teach us right and wrong. But eventually we have to go deeper than... It can't just be a set of rules. It has to be internalized. And that's where the prophets take it to. And then finally Jesus comes in the fullness of time and reveals that all are his people, really. The Jews, they have a special place, but we're all chosen by God.
So, yeah, so I have a question.
So let's be clear. The church deplores war. War is something that is the last resort. While recognizing war as evil, the church does not, though, prohibit her children from participating in hostilities if at stake is the security of their neighbors and the restoration of some kind of justice. Then war is considered to be necessary, though definitely undesirable. In all times, Orthodoxy has a profound respect for soldiers who give their lives on the battlefield for their country. We'd say for veterans as well. The Holy Church has canonized many soldiers, taking into account their Christian virtues and applying to them Christ's words, "Greater love hath no man than this, but that a man lay down his life for his friends." There's a great story about St. Cyril and Methodius, who were at one time emissaries. Before they were missionaries to the Slavs, they were emissaries to the Sultan in Baghdad, the Abbasid Caliphate. And they were there, and they were with the caliph, and the caliph was at that time waging sort of a cold war against the Byzantine Empire.
Wow.
And he said to the brothers, he said, "Why? You have this commandment that says, turn the other cheek. Give, if he asks for your shirt, give him your coat also." Right? You have these teachings that Christ makes. "How come, if I ask you for your kingdom, don't you hand me over your kingdom?" Right? I mean, that's a fair question. "Why do you fight me?" he said. Why do you have an army when your Christ seems so peaceful?"
And the
brothers responded. They said, "Well, your highness, the Lord also said we must tend to the poor and the orphans and the widows. We must love our people. We must lay down our life for our friend. And so we know that if you were to become our king, you would oppress our people. You'd make them leave their faith. You would burden the widows and the orphans, and you would enslave us. So out of love for our people, we defend them, lest they be turned into slaves for you and a false religion." And so, you know, that was his, that, and that's the rationale basically for defending our lands, that we would be willing to lay down our lives for our people, that they could live in freedom, whatever that means. And certainly for Christians, that they could practice their faith freely. And that's a good reason, actually, to defend our country. Because at least in America, we're allowed freedom of worship. And so we defend our people. And so our church blesses chaplains to serve in the military, to tend the needs of the soldiers. And we'll talk more about that in a second. From the Christian perspective, the conception of moral justice in international relations should always be based on the following principles. Love of one's neighbor, people, and country. Secondly, understanding of the needs of other nations. And thirdly, conviction that it is impossible to serve one's country by immoral means. So we should love our country, you know, and we should love our neighbors. We should understand that other countries have needs and validate that, right? Other countries, that's one of the things that frustrates me about American politics. We forget that other countries have their own motives and needs, you know, and they have their own politics. And so we should always respect that and try to understand that. And we should also never use immoral means to pursue our own foreign policy. So this document quotes, rather interestingly, St. Augustine's... Have you heard of the just war theory?
Yes.
We Orthodox don't subscribe to it as a complete theory. But it's referenced here because we don't disagree with it. It's not ours. We don't disagree with it. So I'm going to read it out here.
I've only heard of just war theory as an extreme pacifist.
Well, here's an articulation of St. Augustine's position that is given by this Orthodox document. Here are some of the contingencies, so to speak, conditions for what would be a war that we could fight. First of all, war is declared for the restoration of justice. I'll read it through, we can talk about it. War is declared by a legitimate authority. Force is used not by individuals or groups, but by representatives of a proper civil authority. War is declared only after peaceful means have been exhausted and negotiations have failed. War is declared only if there are well-grounded expectations that the goals of the campaign can be achieved. And then also that the planned military losses will correspond to the situation and the purpose of the war, that is, proportional means. During war, civilians will be protected against direct hostility. And finally, a war may be justified only by the desire to restore law and order. Now, the problem with all these points, frankly, is that there are always ways to skirt around it. So, for example, restorative justice. I mean, Iraq was a war to restore justice, right? Saddam Hussein had the weapons, we thought. You know, was that war, was that a restoration of justice? I don't know. What is a legitimate authority? I mean, technically, George Washington was not a legitimate authority under the king. But that's considered not an unjust war, right? The war of the American Revolution. You know? So there's all these... the victors write the histories, yeah, right? So
it would be easy to have an unjust war and try to make it look like a just war.
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, Hitler's justifications for World War II was that it was unjust. The Germans had been put down by an unjust treaty at Versailles.
Wow.
And they deserved to get back the territory they lost due to the scheming of the Americans and the British and the French. And so justice demands that we take back the land we lost.
They were trying to take back every bit of land that had ever been in part of the
Yes, country. Yes.
They wanted to have the doing to be an empire,
my point simply is... My point simply is that it's complicated, and that in all these things, interpretation and perspective can really matter. In the present system today, it's hard to tell if a war is aggressive or defensive, right? Like, for example, when 9/11 happened, we invaded, I think not without reason, we invaded, first of all, we invaded Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And we did that based upon the idea of defense, right? We're defending our homeland from another attack from Afghanistan, right? Because bin Laden was in Afghanistan planning terrorist attacks.
Yeah.
I think you could make a good defense. That was not a bad thing to do. But was that offensive or defensive? I don't know.
Both.
It's preemptive, right? You know, I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying there are a lot of question marks there that people can consider.
There's a lot of question marks about who is actually responsible for the 9/11.
Of course.
I just know how, even if it was a spy, there were looks at other countries.
But let me continue here. Among obvious signs pointing to the equity or inequity of a warring party are its war methods and its attitude towards its war prisoners and the civilians on each opposite side, especially children, women, and elderly. Even in the defense from an aggression, every kind of evil can be done, making one's spiritual and moral stand not superior to that of the aggressor. War should be waged with righteous indignation, not maliciousness, greed, or bloodlust. Right? This is a problem. You know, and the principle here is that if we're fighting, we need to try to be dispassionate. I had a cousin, one of my cousins married, she's a woman, my female cousin married a man who was in the military, and he just signed up after 9/11, and I said, I'm really glad you're going to go fight for the country and defend us. He said, oh, no, I'm not going to defend, I'm going to kill some Iraqis. He told me, I want to kill people. I want to see what it's like. I want to see it in their eyes. She's not married to him anymore, thank God. But my point is, this person manifests and is a perfect example of the kind of darkness that is described here. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't want to do bloodlust or engage in a kind of maliciousness in warfare. We have to be dispassionate. It points out here that the classic icon, the patron saint of war, like a war, would be Saint George, and it's always interesting how he's shown riding a beautiful white horse, and then the snake or the dragon is black. So we want to be very careful that when we're fighting evil, we don't engage in evil. We don't become what we're trying to kill. You know, we have to stay above it and really preserve our humanity. Lest we become what we're trying to destroy. So, and this is where the church plays a role. The church must be active in training the people and the military if we have the chance. That's why we should have chaplains. And helping to instill a sense that there are limits to what we should do. What I'm saying is there are limits to what war ought to be. You know, we can't bomb civilians. We can't torture. We can't engage in wanton violence. We shouldn't, you know... the Christian conception of the world ultimately is the idea of peace, right? Think of what the Jews say when they say shalom, peace. Yeah. We say in the liturgy, peace be on the wall.
Technically, we must say that too.
Salam alaikum. Yeah, no, it's fine. but the biblical understanding of peace is much broader than just like, you know, not having war. It really is a whole orientation toward doing that which is right. And fostering that, and it begins in our heart. You know, we can't just legislate peace from the Congress. We have to establish it in our hearts first, and then preach that. So, okay.
What?
Peace by God's grace characterized the life of the church in both its internal and external dimensions. Certainly. The grace-filled gift of peace depends also on our human effort. The gifts of the Spirit are manifested only when the human heart is moving, coming the other way, helping to bring us to repentance. So the church's job is to lead us in real repentance and to speak from that place of repentance and penitence about peace. Because Jesus is blessed are the peacemakers. They will inherit the kingdom of heaven. We don't imagine that we can make the world totally peaceful now. There's some like utopians believe that. We don't believe that. Because the only peace that will be here finally is when God reigns completely. However, until that point, we can incrementally do the work of peace because Jesus says we can. Blessed are the peacemakers, they shall inherit the kingdom. So we must sow peace when we can. And if we can't, we try to limit the evil by ourselves, not giving in to the evil, maybe by fighting, but keeping ourselves dispassionate as we fight. So I'm going to stop right here. In kind of conclusion about war and peace, I would say there is a place for pacifism in Christianity, but we should be clear that Orthodox Christianity is not pacifist.
Yes.
If one chooses to be a pacifist as an Orthodox Christian, which I would bless that, if someone came to me and said, Father, I'm just convinced of this, I would say, following Father Hopko, that's fine, you do it, but you must bear the consequences of that. If that means going to jail, you bear that consequence. Or maybe it means you can talk to the civil authorities and become a medical stretcher bearer or something. You do that. You work to make it okay, But you don't fight the state to become a passive. You know, you can't. You know, I don't believe in draft dodging. I don't think that's appropriate.
You can be a conscientious objector.
Well, that's what I mean, though. Yeah. You can do that, but
that's what
but,
I would do if I were drafted.
Well, but Muhammad Ali was that because he wouldn't fight.
He wouldn't fight.
But he didn't run. He said, "Okay, I'll go to prison."
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's called civil disobedience.
And that's civil disobedience, and that's totally appropriate. Christians, you know, that should be the last resort. Before fighting, even, but certainly it's a worthy, blessable thing. So I would encourage. I would say that's fine.
As an individual, it's an option if your right. conscience leads you that way.
Right.
You can be a soldier and enlist if you.
And the church would support that choice too.
I have a question.
Yes.
Does the church condemn torture?
Absolutely.
Okay, because I've heard like some Catholic, not, most people are not, but some Catholics and Protestants try to justify it.
No, I skipped over the paragraph on torture, but I skipped over because I think it's so obvious I didn't have to spend a lot of time on it.
Yeah, no. It just really bothers me when people try to justify it.
Scientifically, it's proven that torture is quite ineffective.
I know.
Because under pressure, people will say anything to make it stop.
Yeah.
So it's not effective, it's inhumane,
it
degrades the person that is doing it. It degrades everybody. If we're images of God, then it's anathema. So torture, you know, it's disturbing.
It's also not necessary, because if you go with the definition of torture that they're already restrained, it's not necessary to prevent them from doing harm.
Right.
But people talk like I've heard Christians like I don't agree with it, but I think Christians try to justify it.
Oh.
Probably.
We ought not to.
Yeah.
If they do it, they can't do it in the name of the church. That's for sure.